So good afternoon and welcome to a special pledge drive show on corporations and democracy, a program that explores issues of community democracy and what we, the people, are doing to create sustainable democratic alternatives to corporate control. From the Philo Studio, I'm your host, Linda McClure, and joining me is my counterpart host, Steve Scalmanini. He and Annie Esposito do Corporations and Democracy on the second Tuesday of the month, and I do it on the fourth. So thanks for being here, Steve.
You're welcome.
The views expressed on this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent the opinions of station staff, members, or board. If you call in when the listener phone line is open, please be aware this show is recorded and may be accessed at KZYXNZ's website archives or played at a later date. Our special guest today in Corporations and Democracy is David Barsamian. David is a lecturer, an author, and founder and director of Alternative Radio. His latest book, Global Discontents, Conversations on the Rising Threats to Democracy, is co-authored with Noam Chomsky. So good afternoon, David, and welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Corporations and Democracy are very important program that focuses on the enormous power that corporations exert over our localities, over our regions, and over our country and around the world.
Yeah, and I know that you've been working in radio for many, many years. Maybe you could... I know Global Discontents is your 26th book, but you started your career in radio in 1978 in Colorado and continue producing your alternative radio program from there, and you have listenership all over the world.
Yeah, it's really grown and expanded over the decades. We're now about to go into our 33rd year.
Wow.
Of broadcasting dissident voices, voices that really are excluded or obscured in most of the media. So it was very interesting, just before you went on, there was someone reading from the founding purposes of National Public Radio, is that correct?
I believe it was, yes.
Yeah, and then, you know, talking about the sacred trust to broadcast the truth. Well, you know, I think the media have failed to a great extent in doing that and have largely taken their cues from people in power in Washington, you know, the big banks in New York and the financial institutions and the like. But media still has a very critical role to play because, as Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a rational and knowledgeable way. But if it doesn't have information, then it could easily be led by the nose. And that's something we have to, of course, guard against, be vigilant about. So lucky to have stations like KZYXNZ in Mendocino County, you know, broadcasting diverse opinions, perspectives that are not usually heard in the media.
So what is it about radio that grabbed you and held you for all these years?
It's a very intimate medium. I can't find any other way to say that, particularly for ideas, because I think what the image does, you know, if we're looking at, say, broadcast television, cinema, documentaries, it robs the imagination to some extent. And radio, you're just hearing the words. It's unfiltered. It's not in any way massaged by other elements, you know, a spectacular scene, you know, where you have anchors, network anchors, you know, standing up in front of, you know, mosques that have just been bombed, or schools that have just witnessed yet another massacre in the United States. So I think, you know, radio is superb to convey ideas. It's a very intimate medium. You go into people's living rooms, into their bedrooms, into their bathrooms, into their kitchens. You know, I have people tell me all the time, oh, I listen to you in my kitchen. Oh, I wonder what that's like. I hope it's tasty. Or I listen to you in the bathroom. Well, don't flush the toilet. Just listen.
Right. I know one of the things I like about radio is because you can sit here at the studio in your bathrobe with your hair in curlers, if I did that, and nobody knows. You don't have to look good to be on radio.
You have to sound good. You have to have credibility. You have to have, you know, organized thoughts and articulate them in a chronological way that reaches out to people. That's not disdainful, that is not in any way superior or arrogant. You know, it's going where people are, and that's so important in terms of organizing.
Now, what was the impetus for the book, this particular one?
Well, clearly, with the election of the great prevaricator on November 8th, 2016, there's been a major shift. Not just in the United States, but around the world. And that's why the subtitle of this book is called Threats to Democracy. It's not just in the United States where we see autocratic tendencies, but in Turkey under Erdogan, in India under Modi, in Hungary under Orban, even in Germany. 90 members of a crypto-fascist party were elected to the Bundestag. This is unprecedented in the history of post-war Germany. Mm-hmm. In France, the fascist party did not win. That is the Marine Le Pen party. But she got about 35% of the vote, which is astonishing. Her father, who is an out-and-out fascist sympathizer, never got more than 12 or 13%. His daughter, Marine, tripled that. So you see this around the world. You see it in Duterte in the Philippines. You see it in Egypt with Sisi. I can name country after country where the right wing is in ascendance. In Italy, for example, is another country where the right wing has gained political power. Poland under Duda, Zeman in the Czech Republic. So this is a very dangerous moment, not just for the United States, but for the planet, because these victories, and it's really interesting that in the past there would be coup d'etats, usually led by the military, to seize power and take over governments. This group, almost all of them except for Sisi in Egypt, have come to power through the ballot box. They're using elections, they're using democratic methods to then implement their undemocratic policies. And that is literally unheard of, where there's been such a wave of these right-wing autocrats. So I think that is a huge concern of Chomsky's, and it's a huge concern of mine. The threat of a war, of course, is escalating with the U.S. pulling out of the Iran Accord, which was working very, very well. In fact, head of the IAEA, the UN agency that sent 10 or 11 teams to Iran, said that Iran was in total compliance. So this is a very provocative thing that the great prevaricator has done, pushed along by well-known Iranophobes like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, who yesterday said, "We will crush Iran." That's a quote.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's a direct violation of the United Nations Charter. Not only is the use of force illegal under international law, the threat of force is illegal. Is anyone talking about that in the media? I mean, I don't watch everything. Maybe, Steve, maybe Linda, you've seen some commentary about this, that the U.S. is in violation of international law, that three close allies of the United States have nuclear weapons and the ballistic missiles to deliver them, yet they are not subject to any kind of UN-authorized inspections. I'm talking about Israel, mm-hmm. India, and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
They get a free ride. Iran, which is signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, is held under a very tight scrutiny and is being micro-examined. And, you know, even so, the head of the UN agency, Yukiya Amano, said that Iran is in compliance. The deal is working. And so what the U.S. has done is take the advice from Israel and Saudi Arabia, who have their own, you know, interests vis-a-vis Iran. They're both extremely hostile to Iran. And it's a very dangerous situation. It could lead to yet another war in an area of the world that is just drenched in blood.
And what role do you see the United States playing in these unprecedented elections, electing through, although not all those elections are fair and free, they don't seem like they're all democratic elections, but still, that Trump being elected or other foreign policies, why is the world in general turning more right wing?
Well, certain elements of the world and certain elements in the United States, so I'm not saying the American people are doing this. The ruling class has been drifting steadily to the right ever since the early 1980s when neoliberalism was imposed as the reigning economic doctrine. And neoliberalism has seen the greatest transfer of wealth from the bottom to the 1% and the 0.1%. It's been a bonanza for the rich and the well off, and everyone else has been basically struggling to make ends meet. They're fighting enormous economic difficulties, student debt, affordable housing. Basically, you know, it's there is no such thing as affordable housing. And, you know, I just came back from Fresno. I mean, you wouldn't think of the Central Valley as a place of high rents, but I found out that even in Fresno, rents are skyrocketing, housing prices are skyrocketing. I was in San Luis Obispo a few weeks ago, in Berkeley, in San Francisco, everywhere, Seattle, where I'm speaking to you right now, Boulder, prices, housing prices are just going through the roof. So it's very difficult for people to find places to live. Or if they're renting, they're paying a huge amount of their income toward rent. So, you know, those kinds of things, economic pressures on families have escalated. There's been, you know, as I said, bailouts for the banks and sellouts. Now, you know, we got sold out, the banks got bailed out, was one of the slogans of the Occupy movement. And I think that's, you know, basically captures the essence of that deal, where the ruling class decided to save themselves and save the banks and, you know, basically throw the rest of the population under the bus. And this has created an enormous amount of resentment, antagonism, hostility. And then you have these, and I'm going to use this collectively, demagogues come along who start pointing fingers and scapegoating other groups to blame them for economic problems and political problems that the ruling class is responsible for. They are in power. The people that they're scapegoating are certainly not in, you know, holding the reins of power. So it's you know, we're making the world safe for hypocrisy, as Michael Parenti says, not democracy.
And so that might be, I'd like to talk a little bit about how is listener-sponsored radio different than commercial radio when we're talking about how people gain the perspectives that they do. And just remind you, we do have a match, a $180 match, from
Dennis and Patty Dong in Auburn.
In Auburn. You know, I was born in Auburn.
I did not know that.
They must be listening on the online.
Mm-hmm. And the number here to donate for our drive is 895-2233 to support this kind of independent radio that you hear here in Mendocino County. 895-2233.
Remember, for a donation of $150, you will get a copy of David's book, Global Discontents, Conversations on the Rising Threats to Democracy, co-authored with Noam Chomsky.
Mm-hmm. Now, David, if I might go back a couple of minutes to your talking about international law and such, you know, I do not hear anywhere in the media about the goings-on that our government is involved in, let alone others that we're allied with, and international law. It just doesn't come up ever since the Iraq invasion. And before that, even during the 90s, when there was, air bombings of, locations inside Iraq, it was civilian infrastructure we were destroying, but there was no accountability for that. We're talking about the water plants and sewage plants and things like this. It's still going on. That's what's going on in Yemen right now and other locations in the greater Middle East.
A couple of weeks ago, the great prevaricator actually made a correct statement. The night he bombed Syria,
mm-hmm.
He sent 105, I think 104 cruise missiles, costing tens of millions of dollars. You know, money aside, when it comes to the Pentagon, no amount of money is too much for them to spend. But that figure is kind of interesting. It's 10 times the number of Syrian refugees that were allowed into the United States in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Just about 10 or 12, that's it. For, a country that has largely been shredded to pieces as a direct result and an indirect result of the criminal invasion of Iraq, which the corporate media and its apologists in the political class keep calling a mistake that was, it was done because of false intelligence. It wasn't done because of false intelligence. The intention was to invade Iraq and to create fake intelligence, to create, mobile chemical labs and mushroom clouds and launch on 45 minutes and scaring people half to death where they felt it was absolutely necessary to destroy Iraq. And that's what's happened to Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. Millions have been displaced internally and externally. That spilled over into Syria, where the same type of numbers obtain. Even many more millions are refugees, external refugees, internal refugees, and killed and wounded. So U.S. policy is largely responsible for the mayhem and chaos. Now, let me backtrack to April 14th, where I said, the great prevaricator occasionally says something, it could be statistical error, that is absolutely true. He said, the Middle East is a very troubled region. He said this twice in three sentences, by the way, given to his tendency to repeat himself multiple times. But the interesting question to raise here is, why is it such a troubled place? We agree, it is a troubled place. What role does U.S. foreign policy and meddling and intervention have to do with creating a very troubled place? Those questions cannot be asked. We can talk about Iranian behavior. We can talk about Syrian behavior, Iraqi behavior. We can never talk about U.S. behavior because we are in the clouds or above the clouds. An international law does not apply to the hegemonic power, to the United States of America, where the breaking of law is commonplace at a very high level. And by the way, this is totally nonpartisan. This is not I'm not arguing against Republicans. The Democrats do the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm,
you know, look at the record. I mean, the historical record since the end of World War II is that there has been virtually no dissent between the two political parties when it comes to imperialist aggression. They have differences in terms of tactics. Should we invade on May 1st or wait until June 1st? Should we use B-2 bombers or B-1 bombers? They have those kinds of tactical differences. But the consistency of the policy ever since the U.S. became the global hegemon in 1945 is pretty hard to miss. Yet, the media do miss it because they cannot ask the question of responsibility. They cannot ask the question of accountability. Why are war criminals allowed to go walking freely around the country? I mean, I was just in California a couple of days ago, and I said, you know, these guys, and they're almost all guys except for Condoleezza Rice and Madeleine Albright and a few women, they should be serving time in San Quentin instead of having a good time going to parties. You know, we read articles about George W. Bush, how he's become a great painter, and he's showing, you know, his paintings around the country at different art galleries. You have people like Rumsfeld writing their memoirs, Dick Cheney going on, radio and TV and being treated as with great veneration and respect as some kind of senior statesman. All of these people, without exception, and roll it back to the 60s, to McNamara, to Kennedy, to Johnson, to Rusk, the Bundy brothers, Walt Rostow, all of them war criminals that should have been held to account. But there's one set of rules for the master and another set of rules for everyone else. And we see that played out. And as all, almost on a daily basis, and as all, like to say, sometimes the hardest thing to see is right in front of your nose. And for a lot of these media outlets, they're, completely dropping the ball, on this issue of aggression, on lack of accountability, on international law. I mean, international law seems only to apply to the designated enemies of the United States. If you're on the U.S. team, if you're one of the, major allies of the United States, you get a free pass. So look at Saudi Arabia. Mike Pompeo was just decrying the fact that Iranian missiles were shot at from Yemen into Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. What is Saudi Arabia doing in Yemen, by the way? It's absolutely destroying the country. It has created the world's worst human rights catastrophe, crisis. There is no water in Yemen. It's a water-stressed area. There are food shortages. There have been outbreaks of cholera and other diseases, and typhoid as well. And this is our ally, Saudi Arabia. We're, incidentally, the very first country that the great prevaricator visited was, in fact, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is one of the most feudalistic, misogynistic, homophobic, Iranophobic nations on the face of the earth. Extremely reactionary. They have funded the jihad in Afghanistan. They bankrolled the Taliban in Afghanistan and in Pakistan when the Taliban spilled over into Pakistan. They were 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. There's no accountability. Mm. I mean, it's really outrageous. People should be shouting from the rooftops like Howard Beale, "I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take it any longer." Mm-hmm. And, I don't think we should. I think people should, take their cue from Howard Beale and, shout out, get off of Facebook and into the face of these crony politicians who are wedded to corporations, who depend on corporations, and rich gazillionaires like Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers and Peter Thiel of PayPal and others who are just flooding the political scene with tons of money. So it's, you know, our democracy is under attack. Corporations, of course, feed off of all of these things, particularly the military-industrial complex. So if you're Lockheed Martin, if you're Northrop Grumman, if you're Boeing, if you're Raytheon, you're just in the driver's seat. You cannot believe the good luck that you have that the U.S. keeps expanding the zone of the war on terror, this forever war that began in September of 2011, which has no end in sight. There's more and more conflict. In conflict, weapons are used, and then, well, you have to sell new weapons to replace the old weapons. And then, you know, you have to upgrade your weapons, as we're upgrading now to the tune of $1 trillion, not billion, $1 trillion, the nuclear arsenal of the United States is being upgraded. They'll be smarter and faster nukes. I mean, we're talking about Armageddon here. We're talking about the end of civilized life as we know it. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of weapons of mass destruction that the U.S. is promoting. And, you know, I haven't even mentioned the other existential threat to humankind, and that is the climate change crisis. The, you know, we're in the age of the Anthropocene, where man-made causes of increasing, pumping carbon dioxide, CO2 into the atmosphere is increasing global temperatures. It's going to have a catastrophic effect in the next decades, not centuries. In the next decades, there are going to be huge movements of people. There'll be climate refugees in the millions leaving island states in the South Pacific and in the Indian Ocean. Low-lying countries like Bangladesh will be underwater. This is the other major issue we should be talking about, but everyone is focusing on now on, you know, the, just the military aspect, which I think, of course, is important, but we cannot take our eye off what's happening to our mother. Our mother is under assault. She's under attack, and it's our duty. Hear me, raging grannies and others out there. It is our duty to protect our mother. This is, you know, our Mother Earth is under assault. So, you know, all of these things have happened or are occurring right in front of us, yet, you know, there's more attention. Haven't done a statistical study yet, but I hazard to guess that there was more newsprint and air, TV and radio time devoted to the royal wedding last weekend than has been given for the whole year to climate change. So a threat to civilization, a threat to human existence, is getting less attention than the royal wedding last weekend. That's a pretty shocking thing.
And you are listening to Corporations and Democracy. I'm your host, Linda McClure, and joining me is co-host Steve Scalmanini. And our guest is David Barsamian, who is a multifaceted gem to our nation, an author, lecturer, founder, and director of Alternative Radio. Really appreciate you being with us today, David.
Well, I think it's important, you know, to support community radio. KZYX and Z is a locally based radio, and you hear great programs. I can't think of many stations that have a program called Corporations and Democracy, which, you know, focuses on this absolutely critical relationship that corporations have to undermining democracy. You know, it was the great Alex Carey, a sociologist from Australia, who's not very well known in the United States, but he's written several books. The most important book is called Taking the Risk Out of Democracy, and which he states that the 20th century, and one could say the 21st century, you know, saw three great historical developments. One was the rise of democracy. The other was the rise of corporate power. And the third one was the rise of propaganda by corporate power to undermine democracy. So citizen-driven, mostly volunteered, staff community radio is a it is an alternative. It's an island in a sea of corporate control and corporate information. And so I think we got to make that island bigger and bigger.
You reminded me a moment ago of your quote early on from Thomas Jefferson, which was done in probably in the late 1700s. And that was about 125 years or so before the creation of public relations business and the propaganda business by Mr. Bernays and such. And so little did Mr. Jefferson know what we'd be dealing with, over 100 years after he said that quote.
The founders, you know, could not envision the huge growth of electronic communications and its ability to insinuate itself into people's lives in very profound ways.
One of your books was The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting, and that was done at the around the same time as Propaganda and the Public Mind. What was the premise of that book?
Well, I looked at, I was concerned about what was happening to public broadcasting in the United States, from its lofty ideals that were encoded in the 1968 Public Broadcasting Act, 1967, excuse me, the last piece of Great Society legislation that Lyndon Johnson was able to get through before his presidency went up in flames because of the wars in Indochina. I was looking at, you know, studying the roots of community radio and of public radio in the United States, and I found, you know, their goals and aims were very inspiring: to be an alternative to corporate control news, to be a forum for controversy and debate, to get perspectives on that are largely occluded or excluded from mainstream discourse, to provide a voice. I'm almost quoting here from the Carnegie Commission report, which was adopted in the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. Another aspect of it was to provide voice for those in the communities that may otherwise be unheard. And so I found this, you know, to be really inspiring. But as I was studying and more, you know, I found the actual performance that fell far short of these very idealistic goals. And so that's why I called the book The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting. And of course, public broadcasting has come under tremendous political attack from the right wing, which has constantly, ever since the early 90s, even before that, been harping about the so-called liberal bias of public broadcasting in the United States. There's very little evidence to support that charge, incidentally. There are some progressive community radio stations, that's for sure. But overall, the mainstream public stations tend to be rather conservative, rather, careful about what they say and are very scrupulous about presenting both sides of a particular, controversial issue. I think that's, an important thing to do, but not when the perspective that's offered ranges from A to B rather than A to Z. There's not a real, there's no one talking about U.S. imperialism. I challenge you and anyone listening to find that phrase, anywhere in the media, outside a few progressive sources like alternative radio, for example, where I talk about it all the time, or, there's a few other such programs. So there's a limited discourse, and as long as you fit within that discourse, you are allowed to proceed. If you If you don't, you encounter all kinds of, you know, financial obstacles, political obstacles, the threat of being sued, propaganda campaigns that are carried out, full-page ads in newspapers, you know, decrying this or that radio station for having this or that person on the air. I mean, if you look at, you know, we were talking about Noam Chomsky, I mean, arguably one of the greatest, you know, intellectual figures that any country has ever produced, much less the United States. You know, he's been on the NewsHour with PBS once, and that was in 1990, and he was cut off. You know, I can give you the details if you like, but, you know, he was trying to explain that Iraq had serious territorial claims against Kuwait, that the British Empire sliced Kuwait off from Iraq, made it a British colony. Okay, that was one issue. The other issue was that Kuwait was slant drilling into Iraqi oil fields, taking a valuable oil, which should have gone to the benefit of the Iraqi people, into the coffers of the Kuwaiti emirs. So he was talking about this, and they literally cut him off. Professor Johnson, we're running out of time. Sorry, that's it. The reason I bring this up is the point that Chomsky and Edward Herman and other media critics have made. If you are arguing something that is not generally accepted or generally known, you need time. You need to develop your argument. You need to provide context and history and background. You know, if you just say, if you just mouth some syllables, you know, that the United States intervenes around the world because it's promoting democracy and freedom and human rights, and, you know, it wants to protect women, and somehow the Marine Corps is a feminist organization, things like that, you don't have to back any of that up. That's just a given, because that is embedded wisdom. That is entirely accepted. But if you say something contrary to that, that, you know, it's not altruistic, the interventions are based, you know, have other motivating factors, not simply helping people in quotes. So, to make a long story short, and I'm making a long story long here, it's important that we have, you know, community-based radio that is responsive to the needs of the community and also provides news and information and cultural programs as well that otherwise, you know, cannot be found, readily found.
So, we've talked about these atrocities that are going on all over the world, all the hot spots, and whether it's the largest concentration camp in the world that's Gaza, or whether it's Yemen that's just being obliterated, where is the global accountability? Who is going to do something about it? It doesn't seem like the UN is able to stop these things. What can we expect?
Well, I have some good news for you, Linda.
Oh, good.
We're leftists and progressives, and, you know, it's all gloom and doom, but an amazing thing just happened in a tiny, poor, landlocked country in the Southern Caucasus known as Armenia, a country of maybe 3 million people, dirt poor, as I said, laden with 70 years of Soviet rule of corruption and oligarchy. People turned out in the hundreds of thousands. The total population of the country is under 3 million. So it's just a massive display of citizen outrage. They shut the country down, the railroads, the airports, all the major thoroughfares and streets. Ministers could not get to their ministries because of popular people were blocking the roads. There were sit-ins everywhere. And this was a nonviolent revolution. And after about 3 weeks of sustained citizen protest and outrage, focusing on the mafia-style government that they have there, that government toppled. and someone was democratically elected, Nikol Pashinyan. It's an amazing story of what popular revolt can still accomplish, and that this was done nonviolently is more, even more endearing, I think, and more significant. That the powers, they had the guns, not the protesters, not the people. The state had the guns. The guns, the soldiers, the police did not open fire. They did not use tear gas. They did not have sniper nests picking people off one by one. They did not kill journalists. This was a peaceful revolution, and it's quite extraordinary, and we should be inspired and heartened that if that kind of thing can happen in a poor, backward country with a tiny population, why can't it be done here where we have so many advantages, where we have so many privileges? How many of us have Facebook pages? How many of us travel around the country and around the world that can, you know, how many of us have passports? I dare say almost all, many of us. So, we have possibilities here that other people don't have, advantages, I should say. And we should, as Muhammad Ali said, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Get into the face of these people. As I said earlier, I was in Fresno for the last couple of days. Guess who the Congress representative is in Fresno? None other than Devin Nunez. So it would be I know this is an oxymoron. He's the head of the House Intelligence Committee, and he has been a major apparatchik for the great prevaricator, leaking information as to the proceedings, which are supposed to be confidential and secret, to the White House. So I was telling people there, organize. Whenever he comes into your district or the district, be in his face, block entrance to his office, write letters, scream from rooftops, do what you have to do. But get out there and act. So I'm very encouraged, by what happened in Armenia. And I think, there are stirrings now with Black Lives Matter, with hashtag MeToo and other movements, 350.org on the eco front, and other grassroots organizations that are saying basta, that are saying enough. We've got to save our planet. We've got to save, the country from despotism.
And I have my eye on what some of the teachers are doing in some of the red states. That is
absolutely
significant to me.
That's a huge story. I mean, you're talking about the reddest of the red states.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Arizona, West Virginia, Kentucky, Indiana. This isn't New York or California I'm talking about. These are extremely, deep red states. Yet the teachers, rose up en masse and said enough to being underfunded, enough to being, treated like, they're not worthy of getting paid properly, enough of, education budgets being slashed, enough of all of that. And, have achieved remarkable things. That shows you what organized people can do.
So
they may have the money, but we have the people, and organized people can beat organized money.
Right, I know in my career as a union organizer and representative, it really is one of the most exciting things for a workplace when the workers get how much power they have when they stand together and make reasonable and fair demands. How much power we the people have if we recognize it and use it. And you're saying that the hope, if I'm hearing you right, the hope that we have for changing things globally is us, that there isn't going to be the UN that's going to come in and save us or us as a collective humanity, but it is we the people who have to make the difference.
Historically, that has been, proven time and time again. People in power don't wake up and say, this law is unjust, or this, legislation needs to be passed to correct the societal wrong. They do it because of heat in the streets. They do it because of the noise that people are demanding change, and that's when change happens. You know, and I was there was a 26-year-old Armenian woman who's a mother of an 18-month-old, and she's a digital specialist. She said about the uprising in Armenia, I'm quoting her. Her name is Armine Hagopian. It did not start on the street. It was something that happened in your mind first. So it does start in your mind. It starts with an understanding of who has power, who is benefiting from the existing sets of rules, and what can be done about it. But that first step starts in your mind when you realize that there is gross inequality, that a certain group is enhancing its wealth at the expense of the larger sectors of society. So I think that and there you see the role of propaganda in kind of rendering people into a comatose acceptance of the status quo. There's nothing you can do. Leave it to the experts. Everything will work out. Worry about the royal wedding, or did the Giants make a good deal when they signed Evan LaGloria? What about Madison Bumgarner? Is he going to come back from his injury? Will the 49ers win the Super Bowl? Worry about those kinds of things, weapons of mass distraction, as I call them, instead of what is happening to your society, what is happening to the environment. I mean, again, the destruction of the earth is happening right in front of our eyes, and we're allowing greedy capitalists to accumulate more and more wealth at the expense of destroying this precious blue dot in the universe as Carl Sagan called planet Earth.
So, David, we just have a minute left. Give us contact information and how people can follow you more closely.
Just go to the Alternative Radio website. It's Alternative Radio, all one word. .org, alternativeradio.org. You can get a free catalog. You can just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977, 1-800-444-1977, and we'd be happy to send you a catalog. The program is about to launch its 33rd year. We're still going strong, and we're going to hope to visit Mendocino County again and meet with KTYX activists.
We've got 15 seconds,
and we're
getting cut off in 10 seconds now. So thank you so much, David.
Pleasure to have you, David. Welcome.